Good evening, everyone. I'm Gianluca Benigno. I'm chairing this lecture, public lecture here. And I'm here also as an academic director of the economic program at the summer school. And we organize a lot of events, social events in particular, I think, but also academic events beyond, of course, the courses that you attend on a daily basis. And this is one of the event that is in program during this third session. And it's a pleasure, of course, for me here to introduce Lorenzo Codogno. Lorenzo is a distinguished economist and has been chief economist and general director at the Italian Treasury up to 1 year and a half ago. And since then, he has joined LSE as a visiting professor at the university, at the European Institute. He has a lot of experience dealing with Europe, I guess, due to his previous job. So today, actually, is going to talk about Europe and is going to talk about what are the challenges and the opportunities for Europe. I think it's a very interesting topic. Europe is at the center of the policy debate, especially both from a political and also from an economic point of view. And Lorenzo has prepared a fantastic lecture, so I leave the floor to him. And we have 1 hour. And after that, half an hour for questions from the floor. So thanks again, Lorenzo, for accepting our invitation, and I'll leave the floor to you.
Okay, thank you, Gianluca. Thank you, all of you, for your participation. I heard that today you had the exams, right? So you can relax now. And let's have a kind of relaxed conversation about the future of Europe. Now, I'll try to be as specific as possible. In other words, I'm not going to, you know, give you kind of wishy-washy, you know, talk about Europe and so forth. But I would like to go into the specifics of the governance steps undertaken during the crisis and up to now. What is ongoing in terms of governance changes, the current debate, and what could be in store for the future, what could be the next steps, effectively. And clearly my focus is on, you know, it's from the economic side, but there are also political aspects, and you will see that. First of all, before, well, this is the kind of agenda, so basically the response to the crisis, what the crisis has triggered in terms of policy response in Europe. The five presidents' report, why we start with the five presidents' report? Because it's the most recent document which basically gives guidelines. It's effectively the roadmap for the future of Europe. So it's a reference document. And then I will touch on the major chapters, a major, you know, stream of works. Effectively, capital market union, which is a major piece of work, banking union, the fiscal framework, how the fiscal framework has changed during the crisis, what is the ongoing discussion right now, what could be the steps in the future, macroeconomic imbalances and reforms, structural reforms. There is an ongoing debate about that and what that can actually mean for the future. A few words about Brexit. You know, we are coming from a major event here in the UK, which effectively, I think, will change in a significant way the outlook for the future and might actually change the path of future integration. So we're going to touch on that. And a few final comments. Let me start with the crisis. The crisis, you know, there are already many, many papers, many analyses on the reasons why the crisis has hit Europe in the way it did. and what are the, you know, the kind of interpretation, the narrative, if you wish, of the crisis. I won't go into the details because it might actually be very controversial, so there might, it might be different views, okay, on this. But let me say that at least in terms of the policy response, you can say that there are four lines of interpretation, if you wish. First is lack of discipline, fiscal discipline. Why is that? Well, you know, before the crisis, you can argue that a number of countries have not basically or did not have enough incentives or have not adjusted the public accounts in good times enough to basically have sufficient buffers to withstand a crisis the way that we had. Then other people might argue that the so-called debt vigilantes were not fully active. In other words, financial markets were not really properly differentiating government bonds of different countries. So, you know, before the crisis, spreads were very narrow, although it was not just a European phenomenon, but it was a global phenomenon. But as a matter of fact, you can argue that the fiscal situation was not strong enough to withstand the crisis, and therefore the crisis hit, and then we had problems in Europe. A second line of interpretation was that there was misallocation of resources. Typically, given the low interest rate environment that prevailed after monetary union, a lot of financial flows moved from Northern Europe to Southern Europe. So basically from Germany to Spain, Portugal, a bit less in Italy, but Greece, for instance. And this capital went into peripheral Europe, so to speak, Ireland a lot, of course, yeah. Went into peripheral Europe, which effectively means that there was capital inflow in the balance of payments of these countries, and these financial resources were not invested in a proper way. Basically, not it was not channeled through productive investment in a way that can enhance potential growth of these countries, and actually ended up in the housing market. Okay, ended up in unproductive you know investments. So there was a huge imbalance within the Eurozone. Suddenly there was a stop of this flow of capital, and then we ended up in a typical balance of payment crisis, which is typical in emerging markets, but the peculiarity of it was that it was within Europe, okay, not you know with the rest of the world. So it was a typical balance of payment crisis. There was capital outflow from these countries, and that effectively triggered a crisis, which didn't result in a currency problem, because there was a single currency in Europe, but resulted in a huge target two imbalance. Target two is the payment system in Europe. There's another line of interpretation of the crisis, which basically says, if you give up the currency and you no longer have this kind of you know adjustment mechanism, you'd better be very competitive. You better have a flexible product market, a flexible labor market. And many countries didn't have enough flexibility. There was still a rigid market for labor and for products, and which effectively prevented an efficient allocation of resources, an efficient reaction, a resilient economy during the crisis. And finally, a divergence in the cost of labor. I still remember during the 2010-2011 when I participated in ECOFIN Eurogroup meetings, Trichet every time showed one graph, which was divergence in unit labor costs in Europe. That was the only graph that he was presenting every time. And effectively, you know, if you have a situation in which you don't have currency adjustment within the Eurozone, you'd better have labor developments in line with productivity. Otherwise, you build up, you know, divergence in terms of competitiveness, which eventually might actually result in a crisis. So that was another line of interpretation. Probably all these four line of interpretation of the crisis were at play at the same time, and that effectively informed the policy reaction during the crisis. So this is a graph. This is taken from an analytical document that was prepared by the Commission before the Five Presidents' Report, just as a discussion document. And basically, you can see here that effectively there was fiscal consolidation before monetary union, the pre-EMU period, and this was from 95 to 2000. At some point, then we got the launch of the euro. The first decade of the euro, there was some fiscal deterioration here. Then, deficits went back to close to zero. Then, at some point, the crisis hit, and suddenly the deficit went from close to zero to more than 6%. But what is really important here is that the debt increased significantly. Then there's been consolidation from 2009 to 2013, but at the same time the debt continued to rise. Why is that? Because it was not only a fiscal problem, of course, but it was a problem with the banking, sector, which translated into a higher debt. So this was the fiscal story. But again, as I said, there is also a competitiveness problem. This is in terms of rigidities. These are OECD indicators of labor and product market rigidities. And you can see here that there seems to be some correlation between the change in unemployment during the years of the crisis and the rigidities recorded in 2008. Same is true for unit labor cost. This is the change in unit labor cost in the period before the crisis. And as you can see here, that has had an effect on unemployment, changes in unemployment during the crisis. So there seems to be, a story here. What was the policy reaction? What was the policy reaction to this situation? First of all, the European Stability Mechanism, which is a permanent crisis mechanism tool, which was introduced. Well, I'm just making a long story short, because clearly initially there was no ESM. There was initially for the first crisis in Greece, governments and the Commission and European institutions envisaged some kind of bilateral loans. Then we got EFSF and so forth. Eventually we got to the permanent mechanism, which is called ESM. And this permanent mechanism is supposed and will remain a permanent crisis mechanism for any future need within Europe. Second, banking union. Banking union is maybe the most important project currently underway in Europe, but it's not complete. But a number of pieces are already in place. The single supervisory mechanism, effectively, basically, the ECB, the European Central Bank, fully in charge of surveillance in Europe. And this is basically done, okay? The single resolution mechanism, which basically is a system that if a bank has a problem and you need to close it down, there is a decision-making process that is set. And then you have a single resolution fund, because if you need money to close down banks and to support the banking sector, you need to have a fund. There are still issues open here, but don't want to get into the details. But then the final step, it was basically came into force at the beginning of this year, is the Bank Resolution and Restructuring Directive, BRRD, which is a major step in the direction of reducing, or at least in the intention of the people that designed that, intended to reduce the systemic risk, because effectively, it is the directive that introduced at the beginning of this year, the so-called bail-in. So no longer public money pumped into the banking sector when there is a problem, but if there is a problem, shareholders are hit first, then you have bondholders and so forth. There is a kind of pecking order for this, which is problematic. We will discuss that a little bit, because it might actually turned out to be quite problematic. Another major response of Europe to the crisis was the development of the so-called macroeconomic imbalance procedure, which is about the detection and correction of macroeconomic imbalances and vulnerabilities. This is a major step. Why is that? Because before the crisis, the only formal procedure in Europe was about public finance, correcting deficits, public deficits. This is a formal procedure. By formal procedure, I mean that it has to go through a formal evaluation by committees, has to, you know, eventually ends up into a formal decision by policymakers, and eventually might actually lead to sanctions to the country. And this is very important to make it, you know, effective. And that was introduced during the crisis, and it is a very important mechanism to basically push structural reforms. Finally, reforms of the Stability and Growth Pact, because during the crisis, also the fiscal framework has been changed in Europe, and it has been reinforced, and particularly the monetary has been strengthened a lot. And there has been more emphasis on that compared to the past. Finally, Eurostat, more powers to Eurostat. I mean, in the old days, Eurostat had to ask the country to look to see the numbers, and unfortunately, European leaders learned the hard way that that doesn't work that way, because, you know, in Greece, as you all know, effectively the institutions cooked the books, so to speak, and so we ended up with a situation that Eurostat was not aware, but it was not Eurostat's fault. Keep in mind that it was a decision by the ECOFIN and the European prime ministers not to allow Eurostat to have the authority to basically go and read the books and investigate and find out exactly what was going on in a specific country. Now Eurostat have full power to look and at the accounts of individual countries in Europe. All the changes that I mentioned still, and these graphs are taken from the note of the Commission published before the five president report, but still, you know, despite all this, you know, something must have gone wrong, because at the end of the day, if you see here, this is the performance of the United States in terms of real GDP per capita, and that is the unemployment rate. So effectively, the policy response in Europe, inevitably to some extent, was slow, was not fully effective, and the economy was basically weak, not able to withstand the crisis or react in a proper way. So there was a need to do something more, to go beyond. So change again the economic governance, so go much deeper. At the end of 2014, there was a reasonably famous, I would say, Euro summit, and it called for to continue to develop mechanisms for stronger economic policy coordination, convergence, and solidarity. This was effectively a mandate to prepare the next steps for better economic governance in Europe, in the EU, and in the Eurozone in particular. Then the Commission prepared this analytical note. The graphs were taken from that, and they made it clear that it is a political project. It's not just a technical project. Clearly, the euro is a political project, and so that is was. And finally, let me mention Mr. Draghi's speech in Helsinki at the end of 2014. I will actually go into the details here, because I think it's the fundamental speech. Is before the five presidents' report, and if you read it, you will find a lot of concepts, a lot of ideas already in there before the five presidents' report. Clearly, that was that fed into the report itself. But I think it's particularly important, and probably a little bit overlooked by commentators. So let me mention a few things that Draghi said at the end of 2014. Three important things. First of all, which seems to be a kind of obvious you know, things, you need to be better off inside the Eurozone than outside. Because otherwise, you know, what's the point? That seems to be a very stupid thing to say, but if you think about it, if you are part of the Eurozone, so effectively you have given up your currency and your monetary policy, you have given up buffers, mechanisms that can actually, offset external shocks. So if you give up something, you have to have something in exchange, okay, that makes your economy more resilient. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to be part of the Eurozone. So it seems to be an obvious, you know, statement, but it is not. So that was a very strong statement. So what are these kind of mechanisms that could make your economy more flexible, can actually resist the external shocks? Well, one thing is fiscal transfers. But we know that in Europe it is explicitly forbidden. It is in the treaty. You cannot do it, okay? Because it's not a fiscal union, or at least it's not yet a fiscal union. So you cannot do it. So what are the way that you should react to that? First of all, you should make sure that your economy works, and it is resilient, it is flexible, and it can actually work and exploit comparative advantages. So basically, do your homework, okay, first. Secondly, you have to find ways to share the cost of a shock. So if a shock hits and you don't have fiscal transfers and you don't no longer have the currency and the and monetary policy that can offset that, and you have a shock that is specific to your country, then you have to have some kind of mechanism to absorb this shock. And there could be two ways. Or either there is a kind of private plan, if you wish, which is effectively what I mentioned before, the Bank Resolution and Restructuring Directive says that, well, if the bank goes bust, it's not the taxpayer that pays the bill, but it's the shareholders and the bondholders and so forth. So you have to have a mechanism to basically share the burden on the private side. And secondly, you need to have some kind of mechanism that basically at the European level that can offset your shock to the economy and basically preserve the possibility at national level to have some kind of counter-cyclical buffer, some kind of counter-cyclical policies. These are the key concepts about, you know, the policy response that that has to be implemented. Final point here is that there should be no doubt that the decision to enter a monetary union is irrevocable. Why is that? Because if it's not irrevocable, if it is a kind of currency area a la carte, so to speak, then it's not truly a single money. You no longer have fungibility of money, and you have redenomination risk, which was what happened during the crisis in Europe. So it must be irrevocable. But this lesson hasn't been fully learned, I would have to say, because then we had the second great crisis, and again there was threatening, Greek exit from monetary union. Anyway, let me continue on the policy recipe of the ECB, Mr. Draghi, but the ECB, I would say, in general, which is, again, I think it goes even beyond the five president report, which was published after that. Sharing monetary policy is, as I said before, basically deprives you of some adjustment tools. If there is a shock, you no longer have the currency to adjust, you no longer have interest rates. So there needs to be something else, okay? There needs to be ways to spread the adjustment cost. And again, it could be on the private side or it could be public side in a wider area. Other important point, the sovereign debt needs to be a safe haven, because if that is a kind of anchor, if you no longer have the anchor, and that disappears, then you are into trouble, okay? Because fiscal policy can no longer act as a kind of counter-cyclical tool to offset the shock. Joint sovereignty on reforms, that's another very important point. If you are in a monetary union, and within the monetary union you have many forces, many economic forces that pulls the economy in different directions. You have, you know, different developments in terms of cost, in terms of productivity, and so forth, that sooner or later you end up into, you know, into a crisis, into problems. So you have to make sure that the economy is able to adjust and to make and make the reforms that are necessary to basically maintain stability. How do you do that? You have inevitably to give up some sovereignty, or what in a more politically correct way I would say here says exercise jointly this kind of policy-making ability or sovereignty ability. So there should be some joint sovereignty on specific issues related to structural reforms. And then clearly it says that we have to need to use the rules that we have already in a good, in a, you know, deepen these rules. And another important point, we have to shift from coordination into common decision making. And we have to shift from rules to institutions. This is a very important concept which was actually used again in the Five President report. And you will see, because I'll talk about that later, it has been used extensively in the banking union, which is a good example of shifting from rules to institutions, institutions in charge of the whole process, basically the ECB in the case of banking union, but has not been used in the case of the capital market union, because in the case of capital market union, we are still talking about rules, we are still talking about soft coordination among institutions. Finally, private risk sharing, as I said, it must be part of the story. During the crisis, one of the big issues was this link between the banks and the sovereign. So if the banks have a problem, the banking sector has a problem, it becomes a taxpayer problem. So basically, you know, you end up with public money. So I think the whole point was here to make sure that in some way the public sector contributes to the adjustment cost. But this led also to the big debate, which is a big debate now in Europe, about risk sharing and risk reduction. Some countries say, okay, it's good to have risk sharing as a kind of buffer, as a kind of tool in case of external shocks, but we need to have also risk reduction. Actually, we need to have risk reduction first, because otherwise some countries bear an enormous risk versus the other. So you have to have both sides. And also it's key to see whether, you know, you go first for risk sharing or first for risk reduction. Certainly some countries would like to have risk reduction first and then risk sharing, or the other way around. Let me now move to the Five Presidents' report. I think the Five Presidents' report has some innovative principles, in my view, which establishes the principle of risk sharing and the need for fiscal stabilization. I think it establishes also some clear stream of work in terms of the real economy, financial sector, which is capital market union, banking union, fiscal union, and political union, and also establishes a system of rules and guidelines to move towards common institutions. The most probably disappointing part is that it divides in two stages things that needs to be done. The first stage which is called Deepening by Doing, which is up to 2017, is effectively deepening what we already have, strengthening the tools that we already have. And then the second stage, which is the most ambitious one, but it has been postponed to 2017, is about completing EMU. Let me say here, I don't know if you see the small print, but basically, Economic Union Stage 1 basically says creation of competitiveness authorities, strengthening of macro imbalance procedure, stronger coordination of macroeconomic policies. Well, you can say, well, you know, that's important. Yes, it is important, but it's not a big deal. But in the second stage, it becomes more binding, because then you have more convergence and binding criteria for convergence. Financial union, complete the banking union, because as I said, it's not completed yet, and we will discuss that. Capital market union was not in place. This is a new initiative, and reinforce the European system of risk board. And set up a macro stabilization fund. This is very tricky politically, clearly. Okay. And it's going to be in the second, in the final stage. Fiscal union. Here, a number of steps which are already going on, but the key issue is setting up a euro area treasury accountable for the European level. As you can imagine, very controversial step, very ambitious step, and it is has been moved from 2017 to 2025, so moved in the future. So many people criticized the five president report for not being ambitious enough, because effectively all the important decisions have been moved to the second stage. And which is fair, to some extent is fair, because, you know, in the first stage, basically it says we have to use the existing instruments more effectively. We have to work within the treaties, the existing treaties. So very little ambition, and to be quite honest, partly it is justified by the French and the German elections that are going to be, taken next year. And so before these elections, effectively no major steps will be undertaken. Second stage will be the most important one, and will start from 2017 onwards, and it can be very ambitious. Okay, it depends on how you interpret that, and whether there is agreement. Let me also mention that in 2017, the Commission will prepare what is called a white paper, which basically will spell out the specific steps for the second stage, which will be absolutely essential and very and key. Now, let me move a little bit into the details of the four streams that they mentioned. So capital market union, banking union, the fiscal framework, and economic reforms. Capital market union. When the new commission took office after the European elections in 2014, it was decided, well, who should become, commissioner for this major project? Well, it was basically given to a British guy, Jonathan Hill, which to some extent it is understandable, because capital markets in Europe, a big chunk of it at least, is here in London. At the same time, you might say, well, there is to some extent a conflict of interest, because if you have capital markets already in London, what would be the incentive for a British guy to push forward to have a more integrated market in Europe? So it's a mixed feeling, and the mandate, to be quite honest, was somewhat limited. Having said that, Jonathan Hill, in my personal view, did a good job, because within these limits, delivered with a lot of pragmatism, I would say, and did a good job. Keep in mind that the major changes can only happen if you have an institution in charge. And there was no institution in charge, because effectively Commissioner Hill had a kind of soft power of coordination between the Commission, central banks, national watchdogs, and so forth. So I think the ambition was very limited. Then we got Brexit. Jonathan Hill resigned. Now the responsibility is to another commissioner. And I think it's a big question mark right now, because, you know, you can say, well, we have a union without capital markets, because the UK is no longer part of the European Union, and the capital markets of the European Union are based mainly here in London, or you have capital markets without a union. So basically, London becomes the capital markets, but kind of Singapore-like situation, if you wish. So it's outside; it's a kind of offshore center, not really in the union. So I think we now live in this kind of limbo, okay? And I think everything is on hold. I think we need to see a solution in terms of the negotiations on Brexit first, and then we need to envisage some kind of strategy for the future in order to bring this project forward. At the moment, I would say it's a bit stuck. Banking union. Banking union is probably, as I said, the major project. It happened almost by mistake, I would say, in the sense that we had the Spanish banking crisis at some point, and as you probably remember, at some point there was a need for some kind of European intervention. And the intervention was done by the ESM, so there was European money into the Spanish banking sector. But at that point, we said, well, we cannot allow the situation to go on like this, because effectively, if there is a banking sector in one country, in the Eurozone or in the EU, that has a problem, it becomes a problem for the government of that country, and therefore it becomes a problem for the whole of Europe. So let's design a banking union which has a strong emphasis on centralized surveillance. And that was done. It was done surprisingly quick. It was quite effective, I would say, because, again, there was a clear mandate to the ECB. The ECB is a very good institution with a lot of very good people, skilled people. They worked hard and basically delivered, in a very short period of time, a coordinated surveillance at European level. So single supervisory mechanism, which is fully operational by now, okay? And then a single resolution mechanism. There are still bits and pieces that are missing here, because the national backstop, the European backstop, is still missing to some extent. But you know, the advance has been substantial. There's one major missing point, which is the European deposit insurance mechanism. Why it's important? It's one of the three legs of banking union. For stability is essential. Suppose that you have a specific shock in one country and you have bank runs. Banks are, you know, under severe pressure. Depositors are afraid to lose the money they have in the bank. And therefore, you need some kind of insurance. Now, if you have a specific shock to one country and there is a national backstop, so a fund by banks, which is not sufficient, this might actually become a widespread problem, and it can actually spill over into the rest of Europe. So you need basically a big facility at European level. Why it's so controversial? It is controversial because if you look at the numbers at deposits in Europe, it's a huge number. Okay, so if you ask, I don't know, the Germans to guarantee the deposit in Spain, in Italy, or in Greece, that's a big number for the Germans as well, okay? So it's a very controversial for that reason. We are talking about big numbers here, potential big numbers. But the good news about, you know, when you have an insurance is that if you have an insurance, it's like a guarantee or, you know, a good chance that the disaster is not going to happen, okay? Because if you have the insurance, you prevent a bank run, you prevent worries by investors, and therefore, you know, but again, as proved to be extremely controversial. So it's still the missing point here, still the missing bit. But in the meantime, everything else has gone on, has moved on, and you know, capital requirements have become very, very pressing in Europe, as you have, you know, seen in the newspapers. The whole banking sector in Europe has been under pressure, particularly in some countries. In a number of countries, the non-performing loans have increased significantly, so the whole banking sector is in a difficult situation right now. You might even argue that maybe the regulatory and surveillance pressure has, to some extent, increased the systemic risk rather than reduce it, but that would leave it open because it would, you know, be another debate for another half an hour. At least, and but you know, it's operational. As I said, the big debate here is: okay, we can have risk sharing at European level, but we want to have also risk reduction. This is typically Germany and other countries versus peripheral Europe, if you wish, debate. And that has been a very important debate, especially ahead of the European Council in June. And the Dutch presidency of the EU made a very strong effort to try to find an agreement, strike a deal on this. So basically deliver also the final leg of banking union. It didn't succeed. So we are basically still... we still don't have the single deposit insurance in Europe because there was no deal at the end of June. And the big debate was about reducing the portfolio of government bonds that banks have. Clearly, if you want to, you know, to introduce deposit insurance, you want to make sure that the link between the sovereign and the banks is severe and it is reduced. One way to do it is to try to reduce the portfolio of government bonds in the bank's balance sheet. How you do it? You can do it in different ways. You can increase the risk weighting of on government bonds, which basically means that government bonds would absorb more capital of the banks, or you can really introduce some limits, say 30% of total asset or things like that. And then you can do it in different ways. You can actually have different timelines, and depends how you do it, because if you do it too quickly, I called it another Deauville moment. Deauville is the famous beach in France when Merkel and Sarkozy had a stroll and they decided what is called private sector involvement. So basically, in the restructuring of Greece, also private investors would have to have some kind of haircut. And that was basically, to some extent, triggering, okay, the market reaction and market pressure. And again, this potentially could be another Deauville moment, but I don't think it will happen in the sense that, again, there was no agreement in July, in June. The whole issue is postponed to a discussion at the Basel Committee level, so an international level, and we will see whether this will go ahead. But it is still a very important point that is missing, because if we want financial stability in Europe, you need to have also this kind of backstop for deposits. Fiscal framework. During the crisis, the so-called fiscal compact was introduced, so basically tougher fiscal rules. One important change is that debt became a much more important variable. A lot more emphasis was put on debt as opposed to the deficit. Also, a lot of emphasis was put on the so-called structural balance, basically the deficit net of one-offs and a cyclical component. If you strip out the cyclical component, you end up with a structural balance. And a lot of emphasis was put on that. Why? Because, of course, you want to preserve the ability of member states to basically offset cyclical fluctuations by means of fiscal policy. So you need to do it. And also, of course, there were sanctions, but they haven't been applied yet, so to speak. Issues with the framework. Structural balances have well-identified problems. in other words, drawbacks, I may say. Potential output is difficult to estimate. There are many methodologies that are used, but it's difficult to estimate. As a result, the output gap is difficult to estimate. And these numbers have high volatility, and there are a number of statistical revisions. So basically, there's a big uncertainty in these numbers. And you have to base fiscal policy on these numbers. So I think this is a very, very important drawback. But unfortunately, we don't have any other way to improve the situation if you want really to do fiscal policy, correcting fiscal policy for the economic cycle. Then I think the framework was adjusted to introduce some flexibility for structural reforms. Now, if you introduce structural reforms in your country, it means that you enhance potential growth. If you enhance potential growth, it's good news also for the budget, for future fiscal position. So you need to allow, effectively, some flexibility in the near term in order to have benefits in the long term. And that was done and has been introduced. Public investment, also some provisions have been introduced to allow some space, particularly for project co-financed with European money. So all these changes have been introduced, are effective. Well, there's been a debate, there's a big debate whether it's been effective enough and so forth, but I'll leave it here. There's a big critique by the IMF on the European fiscal framework. Basically, the IMF says, and to me, correctly so, that it is complex and sometimes inconsistent. The complexity stems from the fact that it has been developed over the years and several layers have been introduced. So the whole system has become very, very, very complex to the point that if you look at the Commission website, there's a thick document which is called Vade Mecum, which is basically the explanation of the translation of all the rules, regulations, and so forth into plain English, if you wish, in order to understand what all the rules means and what it's all about. But effectively, it has become too complex. So there is a need to simplify the system, simplify the framework. Another critique is that the Stability and Growth Pact, the fiscal framework in Europe, has limited fiscal structural reforms because basically has prevented fiscal space in the near term. And then also the other critique is that has limited public investment. Again, some response to this critique has already been delivered and is already part of the framework right now, but not enough. So something more needs to be done. There is a review of the so-called six-pack, two-pack, so basically fiscal compact, and which is forthcoming. And I'm sure that there will be simplification, and I'm sure that there will be some streamlining of procedures and rules, and that is positive in my view. So we will see. But major treaty revisions, I think, is unlikely. Probably there will be more emphasis on what is called expenditure rule. So rather than moving to nominal aggregates or structural aggregates, which are aggregates net of cyclical components, probably there will be more emphasis on how much a country spends on current expenditure. So net of investment, net of automatic stabilizer and so forth, which is again a good development. Creation of fiscal boards. This is a new feature which was included in the five president report. Basically, there will be a new institution, new authority based in Brussels. It is called European Fiscal Board. It will be a kind of independent authority which will have a kind of power to look into the accounts in Europe and have an independent assessment of the appropriateness of the fiscal consolidation, the fiscal rules, and so forth. Is it a major change? Probably not, but it's part of the process. I have to say that there is also, but I'll mention that later on. Finally, the four the fourth, probably the most important stream of work in terms of economic governance in Europe is about structural reforms. Just to make a long story short, there has always been a strategy in Europe for reforms. It was called Lisbon Strategy in the past. Now it's called Europe 2020. And it's about, you know, discussing and peer exchange. It's about finding the best policies in different countries in order to improve the situation for the whole area. In the past, the so-called Lisbon Strategy had no teeth. So it was based on what is called open method of coordination, and basically it was open discussion but no strong enforcement, which was one of the major drawbacks. Now the situation has changed because together with the macroeconomic imbalance procedure, basically it becomes much more binding on a country. If a country is assessed to have a problem, then it has to respond with policies that are basically aimed to address the issue. Euro 2020, again, mixed results in terms of the policy reached, but let me move to a few things that are missing. When we talk about strategy for growth in Europe, we talk about Europe 2020. Europe 2020 is the strategy that, in theory, should encompass everything that is relevant for economic growth, but there are some important dimensions that are missing. One important dimension is the so-called single market. There is an unusual potential, a huge potential source of economic growth in Europe, which is the single market. And the single market for goods and services is not fully integrated yet. And there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. But unfortunately, it's one of the areas where, you know, politics comes in more forcefully, because there are a lot of interests, clearly, and there are a lot of resistances. So it is probably the most unexploited potential in Europe for growth in the future, and it's not part of the strategy. So this is clearly a missing point. Another missing point is the what is called finance for growth. Basically, things to improve financial markets in order to provide more financing for firms, particularly medium and small-sized firms. Well, I'll, given the time, I'll skip this one. Macro imbalances. As I mentioned, there was a strategy for growth. There has been a strategy for growth for many years in Europe, but it has become much more binding since the introduction of the macro imbalance procedure. Why is that? Because it's a formal procedure. Formal procedure means that it has to go through the committees, and the country has to present, has to explain what it has done to respond to the recommendations. And the formal procedure, if you don't deliver, eventually you might be hit with sanctions. Okay, this is the meaning of a formal procedure. And, I mean, no country has been hit by sanctions yet, okay? But a few countries have moved to a kind of limbo. Limbo is between, you know, just a step before the sanctions, so to speak, including Italy. I had this experience, which effectively means that you have a monthly interaction with Brussels, explaining chapter by chapter from, you know, I don't know, maritime navigation to transport, rail transport to, you know, whatever, every, you know, all the steps that you have undertaken in order to respond to the specific recommendations in terms of structural reforms. So I can tell you it's binding because, you know, you are basically, as a country, you are forced to deliver on the specific recommendations. So I think the situation has shifted since the macroeconomic imbalance procedure has become much more binding. Has it been very effective? You know, that's another story. I'll show you some graphs. I'll skip this one. This is a way to spot weaknesses, okay, macroeconomic imbalance procedure. But I'll skip this one. Another reason why the whole monitoring and the whole process become more effective is the so-called European semester. The European semester seems to be a very stupid thing, basically streamlining all budget and reform calendars in Europe, but it has been probably the most important reform in Europe to some extent, because now all budget calendars in Europe, with the exception of the UK, that was never adjusted to that, but most other countries are basically in line. So basically, every country presents the budget, broadly speaking, at the same time. There's a broad discussion at the same time at European level. So there are specific steps, you know, starting with the annual growth survey prepared by the Commission. Then there are dialogues, debates, in-depth review by the Commission. Then you have specific recommendations. Then you have, you know, preparation of the policy documents and so forth. So the calendar is extremely important because basically it puts together all the processes in Europe with one single, you know, agenda. So it has been very, very important. But has it been effective? Mixed feeling here, because if you see here, these are effectively the recommendations. Country-specific recommendation number one, number two, number three, and so forth. And you can see here that the deep green color means that it has been fully, you know, fully addressed, the recommendations. But as you can see, there are very few green spots here. So basically it means that the countries are still struggling to basically fully deliver on the recommendations. And some issues are wide open. For instance, the imbalances in terms of current accounts, you know, it's a big issue that would probably deserve a whole lecture. But as you can see here, that as the surplus in the Eurozone has increased over the years and remains, in my view, one of the major issues which basically produce a kind of deflationary bias in Europe and hasn't been delivered. Let's see, I think I'll skip this one. One other aspect that has been proposed by the Five President report, which I think will be quite important, is to clearly divide in two phases the whole process. One phase will be dedicated to the euro area, which is important because we are not just talking about individual countries, but we are talking about the whole area that needs to actually deliver on some major issues to the country level. And this might actually be an important thing. Another issue that, another proposal that has been put on the table in the context of the Five President report is the introduction of what is called competitiveness authorities at national level, which should basically facilitate, help the country to increase ownership of the reform process and have kind of external, independent entity making proposals and evaluating the situation. Again, it might actually work, it might actually contribute to the process. Clearly, the big stuff is about the second stage, which is not going to start before 2017, and so I will not touch on that. Yeah. Finally, two things. UK, is Europe going to be different in any way following the Brexit? Well, there is probably some argument that could actually support that view. To some extent, the UK has always opposed further integration at EU level, but has not opposed integration at the Eurozone level. Basically, the UK position has always been, you want to go ahead, integrate, and become a fiscal and political union, go ahead, please go ahead. It's also in our interest that you do that. So it has never been an obstacle, okay, the UK, for further integration for the Eurozone. That's also why I think that the fact that the UK is leaving the EU would not help in any way for further integration, okay? However, The UK has always blocked the EU, not the Eurozone, from going ahead with further integration, particularly in the area of taxation, in the area of the fiscal side. Will that situation change? I doubt, because effectively, to me, the EU following Brexit has changed for the time being. So I think the EU is now stuck. There won't be any progress. Why is that? Because I think the agreement made between the UK government and the EU back in February, before the referendum, basically says the countries have the right to basically pursue different directions with different currencies and so forth, basically undermining, in my view, the principle of the EU, which was perceived to be the kind of anti-room for entering European Union, or the reception, if you want, in order to enter monetary union. So that has changed, in my view. So I think we have to take stock of that and basically move in a different direction. What would be the different direction here? Well, let's skip this one. We already talked about this. What is the different direction? I think the different direction is, let's face the situation. There are a number of countries, including the UK, possibly some other countries that are within the EU at the moment, such as Denmark, Sweden, possibly some countries that are outside of the EU, such as Norway or Switzerland, that have a strong interest in having being part of a common area with free movement of capital, goods, services. People, now it's a bit controversial, let's say, but, you know, being part of a family, so to speak, be part of an economic area. So let's face it, why don't we build up on that? And there is already what is called European Economic Area, which is basically the area where, you know, Norway is part of, so forth. Let's build on that. So I think there is a chance here to go in that direction. So build something which is external to the EU, if you wish, but by doing so, you can actually have the UK back into, you know, an economic area which would be beneficial for all. And I think this could be the way to go in the medium term. In the near term, I don't see that happening. Finally, two slides, if I can. So at the moment, no appetite for further integration. Again, everybody is waiting for the elections in Germany and France, and a number of projects, as I mentioned, are stuck. Capital Market Union, the Banking Union as well. So basically, a number of processes are a bit on hold right now. There are a lot of different agendas in Europe right now, different countries, different areas with different agendas, and unfortunately, the current architecture in Europe does not help in terms of bringing everything together. There's a big debate about federalist versus intergovernmental Europe. And this, to me, is a risk for the future. You might have noticed that there's been a very lively debate between some countries, Germany, but not only Germany, also other countries, versus the Commission, versus the European Parliament. So the Commission, the European Parliaments are now perceived to be European institutions representing basically a federalist stance in Europe, as opposed to a kind of intergovernmental approach, which basically means that the leadership in policy making is on the Council, European Council, basically on leaders, European leaders, governments. And I think this contrast for now has remained relatively, you know, below the radar screens. It's something that needs to be watched, because this, I think, is crucial for the future of Europe to find a good compromise, a good working relationship in order to move to the next stage. Another issue, which is particularly important after Brexit, that Germany has become an even bigger country within the remaining part of the EU. And clearly that makes even more difficult basically to accept the leadership, to some extent, of Germany within Europe. So it becomes a more tricky issue from a political economy point of view. Finally, we are now in the middle, in my view, following the economic crisis, we are now in the middle of the political and social crisis in Europe, and the migration crisis has made basically everything much worse. So it's a very delicate situation for Europe right now, and the whole story of migration, again, together with the political crisis, the trend towards populist parties, undermines the very fabric of, if you wish, of Europe, and it's something that needs to be watched very, very carefully for the future. I think I'll stop here, and I'm really ready to answer your questions.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Lorenzo. So I will collect questions from the floor. So please, raise your hands, and I will let the microphone. So someone here. Yeah, microphone is coming.
Yeah, so I think on the second slide you mentioned about a country should be self-sufficient in that they shouldn't need to rely on other countries during a crisis. To what extent would you say they need to be self-sufficient, and isn't that a protectionist view, which is the EU isn't?
It's not about protectionism. It's about making the country resilient. In other words, making structural reforms that are necessary to make the economy resilient to external forces. The product market and the labor market makes the economy flexible. And that is the key issue. So basically, you need to allow the economy of the country to be able to respond to external shocks. Things that the basic crisis in Europe has demonstrated.
You spoke about the impact of Brexit or the potential impact of Brexit on further integration, but how do you feel the upcoming elections, particularly in France with Marine Le Pen and Front National, might impact particularly stage two of the five presidents' report?
Yeah, I mean, it's the tricky issue about Brexit is that basically it has strengthened a number of movements in different countries in Europe that are Eurosceptic. Or populistic in a way, and that is really a risk because to quote one minister, one thing is to have the Eurosceptics in opposition, one thing is to have the Eurosceptics in government and in the European Council. So I think it might actually make things much more difficult in a number of countries.
Is the guy over there?
Thank you. I'd like to ask you your opinion about the results of the stress tests on banks that have has been published 10 days ago. Sorry, and especially about German banks like Deutsche Bank, which were not positive. Do you think that these results will push towards a stronger bank union? Also from...
It's a very complex question and actually difficult to answer in a few words, but let me try to answer this way. I think, following the crisis, there was clearly a need to change a number of
to integrate and to, you know, and to have more surveillance, more integration in a number of areas. Banking is the typical area where, you know, there was clearly need for a banking union. Banking union goes through surveillance. Surveillance is the key ingredient of banking union. If you don't have surveillance at European level, it doesn't work, okay? In order to have surveillance at European level, you need to have an authority, an institution, which is the ECB or the European Banking Authority, which is enforcing such criteria. So basically, it is asking banks to structure their balance sheet, recapitalize themselves when it's needed. Now, you might argue, and I have, you know, I'm on record on that because I wrote on that, if you do that, that is the way. I mean, in an ideal situation, in an ideal world, you have to prevent crisis. But starting from a situation which is already under control below certain threshold. Now we are starting from a situation which is already deteriorating. It's more difficult because you have to move from A to B and address the concerns in terms of fiscal stability, but by doing so, you affect, you impinge on other policy tools. In other words, if you force the banking sector to recapitalize too rapidly, and if you force the banking sector to reduce the balance sheet too rapidly, effectively you impinge on the ability of monetary policy to perform its duty and to transmit monetary policy through the banking channel in a proper way, which to some extent what is happening now. So in other words, banking surveillance, you might argue that at least in some countries or in some areas has pushed too hard probably for a quick recapitalization, for, you know, restructuring of balance sheet, but to some to the point that it has basically offset the accommodation coming from the monetary side of the European Central Bank. So that's, you know, it's debatable, okay? It's debatable, but that's my... So stress test, I mean, the situation in a number of countries is critical. I mean, my own country is certainly, you know, a difficult situation because of the banking sector. I mean, stress tests are good because basically they give transparency. They evaluate in a professional way the full access to information, full banking sector in Europe, and it provides basic information to economic agents. So it's good, okay? But if it comes as a shock to the market every day, and every day there's a letter from the ECB to a bank saying you have to increase capital and so forth, it becomes a source of instability. So you have to have a proper balance in doing this. You have to have a proper balance trying to maintain financial stability on the one hand and try to push for a recapitalization of the system and a restructuring of the system, which is compatible with the other policy, fiscal policy and monetary policy.
Hi. You mentioned that the European digital single market and the single market in general kind of provides the grease to kind of further all these reforms. To what extent would you say the single market, however, is hampered by language barriers, particularly in the digital single market, for instance, or also the free movement of labor throughout Europe?
Been a lot of movement of labor from one country to the other, particularly crisis country to, you know, core Europe during the crisis, which was, you know, unexpected to some extent. So it's not true that mobility of labor, actually I've seen a study that basically shows that during the crisis there has been more mobility in Europe than in the US, which is surprising to some extent. So, but having said that, clearly language barriers, particularly for people that are not young as you are, is still a limitation. This should not be a limitation for the single market in terms of, you know, market for services and market for products. can be overcome easily to some extent. So it should not be a really an obstacle.
Yes, another.
Sorry. Looking to the banking union, my question is about your rating from 1 to 10 on the systemic risk generated by the non-performing loans, and if the European Central Bank of Mr. Draghi is in the same position of whatever it takes BIS.
Surveillance should actually introduce measures that are driven uniquely by the desire to maintain financial stability. Then monetary policy should take stock then and respond accordingly and make, you know, the adjustments that are necessary for the whole economy in terms of adjusting interest rates and so forth. The problem, I think, right now we live in a very special situation in which you have the zero lower bound for monetary policy, which basically constrains the possibility, the ability of a central bank to deliver accommodation easing policies. And of course, we know that the QE, particularly easing, has some limitations. Interest rate now cannot go beyond certain negative levels, because otherwise there are side effects that might be counterproductive. So basically, we live in a very special situation that in which monetary policy has limited ability to respond, is constrained to some extent in responding to the economic developments. So I think in this special situation, you need to be careful to have good coordination between the authorities that do surveillance and monetary policy, which right now in Europe happen to be in the same institution, so the ECB, although they are in different buildings, but it's the same institution. But you need to have to make sure that there is coordination between these two important functions in the economy.
Yes, lady.
I have a question about international trade and how open you think should Europe be now to the trade with other countries, since with the falling resources, it now seems that Europe brings more and more protectionism. So is it right to create like sort of inner market, or it's better for Europe to take part in international trade?
I mean, luckily enough, I would say there's no clear sign that during the crisis, the deep crisis that not only Europe but the world has gone through, there's been a sharp increase in protectionism. Actually, there's no such strong evidence, okay? World trade has declined a bit, yes, but there is no indication that there's been a sharp increase in protectionism. There's no, absolutely no evidence. And actually, I think Europe is working hard to achieve trade agreements with the U.S., as you know, at the moment, which is a bit stuck also on that side, but it's, you know, the process is ongoing, and I very much hope that there will be a decent solution with the UK, because clearly now UK is leaving. So as you know, by leaving the EU means that you have to renegotiate all trade agreements, which is a massive job, which is a tremendous endeavor. And I very much hope that there would be a decent solution between the UK and the EU, in order to find a way that is appropriate and is mutually convenient for all players. It's in everybody's interest to have open markets and open trade. This means within Europe, but also Europe versus the rest of the world.
Yes, there are two questions. Yeah.
Going back to the Five Presidents report, We can't achieve genuine economic union without political union, and with some countries having, like for instance Germany, having such a controlling stake in terms of how policies are made, what would your thoughts be on the pros and cons of disbanding the euro altogether?
Disbanding the euro, in my view, is not an option. Okay? But I think the current state of debate in Europe, it's probably the final slide that I haven't really had time to go into, but I think now there are, I would say, two major schools of thought. One school of thought says Europe, monetary union is by design something fragile, something vulnerable. It is a transition to something else. Something else means fiscal union, political union. So if that is the case, the quicker you move to fiscal union, the better. Because basically, you know, if you are vulnerable, you basically reduce the risks and faster to a situation which is more stable. And I mean, if you look at history, there's no successful case of monetary unions, because either you move fast and you basically, you know, become a country effectively, okay, or at some point it breaks apart. And so this school of thought says, you know, EMU is vulnerable by construction. Because there might be, today it was a crisis due to the factors that I highlighted. Tomorrow there might be other factors, there might be other forces pulling in different directions, so you cannot really keep everything together, okay? That's the idea. So you move faster and you do better. And I think I would agree with this, okay? Then there are another school of thought that says the policy response to the crisis was not ideal. We made a number of mistakes. Let's fix the mistakes. Let's fix the rules. Let's fix the framework. Let's go back to a situation. Let's step back. Let's move one step back, so to speak, and make sure that everything we have is functioning. It's functioning well. And then maybe at some point in the future we will move towards fiscal union. This is, I would say, this is probably the view that will prevail. Okay? It's more likely to prevail. That the euro will remain vulnerable, will remain fragile to some extent for a number of years. But this, due to the political climate, due to the, you know, situation in Europe, I think it's more likely that Europe will kind of step back, try to fix all the problems that we have at the moment. So stage one would probably, hopefully, be delivered. Moving to the stage two will be hugely controversial, be hugely difficult, in my view.
Another question up there.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first question is, after Brexit, is this going to make Europe having one less country who is a strong opposer to further European integration, and therefore there's going to be more incentives for the rest of the European Union nations to integrate further? Or is this Brexit going to give a signal to lots of politicians in European Union to push forward for a more closed-door policies and therefore a stronger force to oppose the further integration? The second question is that if the European Union economy is going to have a slower economic growth in the future, or the economy is going weaker in general in the future, is this going to give more incentives for the rest of the European countries to integrate together in order to deliver a much stronger growth? Or is this weaker economic growth going to disincentivize the countries to integrate further because they think becoming in the European Union is not going to benefit them in the future?
Yeah, very, very good questions.
what Brexit means for the rest of the EU and the Eurozone, I think you have to separate the EU and the Eurozone. For the Eurozone, as I said before, the UK has never been an option. Okay? The UK has always said, at the, even not only at the, you know, at the very highest level, also at committee levels, has always been very supportive of further integration of the Eurozone. So they don't want to be part of it, but they were really supportive for the rest of the Eurozone to go ahead because they had an interest to have a strong economic area. Okay? And I think so. They have never been an obstacle for further integration at the Eurozone level. Okay? So why should the situation change now that they are out? I don't see that, that situation changing, and I don't see the signals, the signs in Brussels that there is a strong drive to move towards further integration now that the UK is out. I don't see that. As for the EU, the situation is different because, again, the UK has basically blocked a number of projects in the past to move towards more integration at the EU level. Okay? And in February, the President of the European Council, Tusk, agreed with Prime Minister Cameron, a kind of compromise, which is now is no longer valid because, you know, Brexit, the referendum said that, you know, the UK was going to leave, but sets a precedent, sets, you know, basically it allowed the UK to move in different directions compared to the rest of the EU with different currency. There's no kind of singularity, if you wish, of purpose for the EU. And I think that this has, to some extent, changed the nature of the EU. So my feeling is that the EU is doomed to fail, is doomed to stop, you know, in terms of integration. It's not going anywhere. My view, is that it should become again the reception, the first step before entering monetary union and full stop without opting out and so forth. And then on top of that, there should be a broader area where the UK can actually come back in and can become again with other countries, which basically share a single market, share a number of other things, but not the currency. I think there must be a way to go in that direction. But if you ask me, is this going to happen? I don't see things moving in this direction right now, or not yet. And the other question, whether I think if there is another crisis, another economic crisis, or the European economy is not moving, is not recovering fast enough, is not, I think it would be bad news, not good news for integration. Because that would strengthen the anti-European, the Eurosceptic movements in different countries. And then you would actually have a kind of spillover of the Brexit move in other countries, maybe a referendum in other countries, and so forth. So I think that the economic situation is key also to preserve support for the project, for the European project. So more growth in Europe would be good news for integration, in my view. No growth is bad news, because that pulls Europe apart.
A lot of questions. We are almost out of time. You ask already a question, so let me give the microphone to him. Yeah, he's coming.
What kind of effects do you think the outcome of the U.S. election could have on the European economy in the next couple years? And could you briefly go into how each candidate winning could affect the economy?
No, I think it could, potentially could be, you know, in a nutshell, I think the U.S. president is very important for foreign policy. I think no matter how it goes, you know, Congress would retain a very important power in the U.S. for domestic policy. So effectively, the big change would be for the rest of the world, for us, for Europe, okay? And then it could be, you know, it depends on the candidate, it could be quite different, the outcome.
guy over there.
Thanks. Does Greece have an economic future in the Eurozone? And do you think that Greece's creditors should adjust their attitude versus, for example, debt relief for the country?
Now is to find ways to put the right pressure on the government, which is not very supportive for the program, let's put it this way, and to deliver on the reforms that have already been put into law. And that is the key issue right now. My feeling is, yes, there should be debt relief, okay, probably sooner, but we know that it's not going to happen. It's not before general elections. And so we'll see. At some point, there would be. The good news is that there is a, you certainly know, there is a big divergence between the reading of the situation by the IMF right now, which is very much in favor of debt relief, but also says that achieving, for instance, the primary surplus 3.5%, which is in the program right now, is not achievable and not feasible, and the European Commission, which says, well, you have to achieve 3.5% primary surplus, and you need to wait for the restructuring. The good news, and there are different economic projections. The good news that the big difference seems to be related to 2016. So at some point during the course of this year, one of the two parts is wrong, would be wrong, and the other one would be right. So I think there will be some kind of convergence, which hopefully will lead to some kind of compromise at the IMF level and maybe at the European level, hopefully. But I'm not very positive
So let me take the very last question.
Do you think any of the political leaders in Europe are like economically illiterate to the fact that like they actually support pro-cyclical policies, or is it totally a political morality play where they don't actually believe it but their constituents do? So pro-cyclical policies, like austerity policies, do you think any of the top political leaders in Europe actually like believe that works, or are they just doing it because their constituents believe that it does?
Basically, you should have tight fiscal policy when you are in good times. When you are in a crisis, you should have leeway, okay, in order to support the economy. So counter-cyclical policy. Now, the issue is whether you can afford to do it. I mean, I was at the Italian Treasury in 2011. We had no choice, okay, because we were under the pressure of financial markets, and we had no choice but to deliver tight fiscal policy. And that was asked by Brussels, but it was asked by financial markets anyway. So the matter is to prepare yourself to be in a situation to have the choice. If you have no choice, you have no choice. So that's full stop.
But sorry, can I say something about this? So it's about Italy. But at that time, you know, one of the factors was that it is true that there was a lot of pressure from financial market, but that was because the ECB was not guaranteeing the Italian debt. So there was a policy mistake at first, no? So that's
Absolutely. I think go ahead.
So you were under pressure because someone else was doing a mistake in Europe.
That would be a long discussion, but you are totally right that at that time the ECB was not pursuing the right policy, at least in my view, that the policy measures introduced by the ECB were not particularly good. You remember in 2011 there was the so-called
SMP, security market program. So basically, ECB was buying bonds, government bonds, some countries. But the program was called conditional and limited, okay, in terms of the amount. Now, if you tell financial markets that you are buying bonds, but it's conditional and it's temporary, what happens? The markets, you know, sell everything. It's like an invitation to sell while it lasts. Okay, and that was exactly what happened at that time. So there was no MT at that time, that was the situation. So probably, yeah, that's the answer. Having said that, the problem was also probably the Italian problem, because the Italy came to that situation in a weak situation, in a fragile situation, so was not able to basically to have the policy tools to respond in an appropriate way. With hindsight, if we look back at the policy mix at that time, clearly fiscal policy was too tight. Clearly it was too tight. And now it's becoming procyclical, because it's too lax in a situation in which Italy is not enjoying a particularly brilliant recovery right now, but still there is growth, some growth, okay? So you might argue that maybe now it should be time to, you know, to do some fiscal consolidation. But, that's it.
We can discuss. So I want to thank again Lorenzo for joining us. So, and for those of you that would like to join us, we're going to have a reception at the fifth floor in this building, the senior common room. So there are some drinks and there's some food. So come upstairs so at least you have something to eat. Okay.